February 23rd, 2016, 2017. Emergency Committee on Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness is now in session. We have a number of things to accomplish today. The goal is to get everybody out the door by 4:30. But before we do anything else, it's Thursday, and this is the day that we actually take a minute or two and remember why we're here. On Thanksgiving, November 25th, 2016, this past Thanksgiving, a U.S. Navy bomb disposal technician, Senior Chief Petty Officer Scott Dayton, 42, of Woodbridge, Virginia, was killed by an improvised explosive device about 35 miles northwest of the Islamic State's self-proclaimed capital of Raqqa, Syria. During his time in service, Senior Chief Petty Officer Dayton earned numerous awards, including a Bronze Star and the Combat Action Ribbon. His death marked the first time a U.S. service member had been killed in Syria since Special Operations troops had been deployed there in October of 2015. Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, commander of the U.S.-led coalition fighting the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, commonly referred to as ISIS, commented on this Thanksgiving, "Please be thankful there are service members willing to take up the fight to protect our homeland from the Islamic State's hateful and brutal ideology." We must always remember that U.S. service members serve bravely and risk their lives, even on occasions of holiday in the United States. As the Pentagon prepares to send more troops into Syria and Iraq into combat ISIS, we can unfortunately expect more lives to be lost. Most of you are aware of that we are currently supporting efforts in Mosul, and the battle is raging there. So our hearts and prayers go to them. Today we're going to move the schedule around just a little bit. We're actually going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2149. We're going to have a good analyst read the preliminary SMS. We're going to then have Representative Johnson speak. Then we're going to call up a gentleman who is about 96 years young who wants to testify about this particular issue. And then we will move on from there. So the public hearing is open. Mr. Vogt.
Thank you, Chair Evans. House Bill 2149 modifies vehicle registration for former prisoners of war down to a one-time cost of $15. In the state of Oregon, ordinary passenger vehicle registration currently costs $86 every 2 years. House Bill 2149 allows prisoners of war to pay a one-time $15 vehicle registration fee and relieves POWs who paid the previous fee from the obligation to renew. We have received a fiscal statement, but not a revenue statement. The fiscal statement is a little bit lengthy. I'll just read you a couple sentences. Last sentence, should the bill be implemented in this manner, the impact to ODOT would be minimal and absorbable within the department's existing budget parameters.
Representative Johnson, would you like to come and share your thoughts about this bill?
Good job, ODOT.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Mark Johnson. I live in Hood River, and I happily represent House District 52. And I thank you for your Thursday remembrance or moment as the proud father of a U.S. Army Special Forces Airborne soldier who's a captain, just recently returned from 5 months in Afghanistan. I appreciate your remembrance. So. This is really a fun issue. You know, I guess I would relate to a lot of, I know a lot of my colleagues would agree with me that occasionally items pop up to our attention from our constituents that we hadn't thought about before. And some of these issues are just really meaningful to get involved in, and this is one of these for me. It involves a constituent of mine by the name of Al Gilbert, and let me tell you a little bit about him. Alfred is a World War II veteran, and he's a former POW. And I emphasize that because we're talking about the greatest generation type POW. He was on the front lines during the landing on the beaches in Normandy 3 days after the D-Day invasion. He and several other members of his company were captured by a German tank division not long after moving inland from the beaches. He was held prisoner for 11 months, being moved between Stalags multiple times, enduring hunger and deplorable conditions, as you can imagine. He and his fellow prisoners finally escaped when their German guards abandoned the Stalag during the bombing of Dresden. They walked towards Czechoslovakia. until they encountered Russian forces and were finally returned to Allied territories after that time. Alfred was honorably discharged from the U.S. Army on November 29th of 1945. He and his family later moved to Oregon, where he worked in the paper mill industry for 40 years. This is where the need for the bill comes in. Last summer, Alfred tried to get his ex-POW registration and license plates, but he ran into a small problem. He and his son-in-law, Keith Moore, who's with us today, went to the local DMV in Sandy to apply for the registration and plates. Keith's the veteran himself, and he knew that disabled veteran plates require just a one-time fee. He thought that POW plates would be the same. However, Alfred and Keith learned that they would have to pay the full price for the plates, pay for the registration renewal, and pay a registration fee to Multnomah County, costing a total of $153 that day and more fees later down the road to renew. So as you know, and as was laid out in this bill summary, disabled veteran plates are currently available. They're permanent. They're not subject to Multnomah County's registration fee, and they would have a one-time total cost of $44. For ex-POW plates, they have to be renewed. There are ex-POW plates, but they have to be renewed every 2 years, are subject to Multnomah County registration fee. They cost $153, and they require an additional $86 every time they need to be renewed. So the point behind House Bill 2149 is that it would allow former POWs to pay a one-time fee for their plates, the same as we currently allow for disabled vets. Establishes a one-time registration fee of $15, and this is the same language that already exists for disabled veteran plates. So I would just add that, these are disabled vets, vets who have actually served time in captivity in service to their country. They deserve all the support we can give them. And this bill would go a long ways towards letting, I think, a small subset of our population in being able to experience that benefit. It's my understanding that there are currently 33 former ex-POW plates in Oregon active right now and 92 plates that are no longer valid for reasons we don't know. Perhaps their registration expired, they haven't been renewed, or perhaps those folks are no longer with us. But for the interest of time, I wanted to give Keith a chance to share his views, and then if Alfred's available, he's at home. He had a brief health setback recently. He's, as he said, 96 years young, but he certainly is paying attention to what's going on here today, and if possible, I'm sure he'd love to say a few words. So
we will call him when it's best for us to do that. Would you prefer to speak before him, or would you prefer him to speak before you?
I can speak now.
Go ahead, and then we'll call him after that.
Great, thanks. Hello, Chairman Evans and constituents. My name is Keith Moore. I live in Gresham. I'm also a Vietnam veteran and a retired police officer from the Midwest. As iterated with Representative Johnson, we went to back in July to try to get the plates renewed and to not renewed to be able to appeal POW plates, and we found out that was not the case. So what I'm prepared is just basically speak on the behalf of the family as well as for Al in regards to this matter, and like to bring it to the chair's attention. And I'd like to read, if I may. It says, the family of the Alfred Gilbert, our father, who would like to take this opportunity to express our gratitude to the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness, as well as the Representative Mark Johnson for his introducing in the bill, House Bill 2149. This bill would be revising the Oregon State statute providing a one-time decreased vehicle registration fee for the former prisoner of wars. We are humbled that we have taken the opportunity to listen and review the documents supporting the request of our father's behalf. Unfortunately, as we discussed, he's not able to attend here at the hearing today. But we are, as a family, are very supportive in this agreement of revising the Oregon State statute is long overdue for the servicemen and women of the United States Armed Forces that found themselves being POWs during war or military conflicts. We would like our father and other POW veterans in the past and in future, Lord forbid, to be recognized for the sacrifices they endured during the time they were POWs by the state of Oregon and its governing body recognizing the POW veterans and having a one-time decreased registration fee of their vehicle registered in the state of Oregon with permanent Oregon ex-POW registration and plates. We, the family, as well as Alfred Gilbert, greatly appreciate the work and the time that has been put into this. And this signed respectfully, Alfred Gilbert, and on his family behalf of Alfred Butch Gilbert, which is named after him, and he was the son that was born while he was in captivity. David Gilbert, his late son Bruce Gilbert is no longer with us, and his two twin daughters, Penelope Moore, my wife, and his her twin sister, Pamela Gilbert. In closing, I myself would like to thank the Chair Evans and the Chair representatives here in me and my father-in-law to be able to speak today and to help testify and hopefully in regards of revising this this long overdue statute. It's very humbling that we are able to present this not only for myself and my father-in-law, but also for any POWs that are still in that same situation. And I thank you very much.
Thank you. Before I ask for any questions, what was the rank of Alfred when he retired?
Private.
All right.
He spent most of his Army career basically in captivity.
So they didn't give him Lance Corporal or anything on the way out or anything like that?
Not to my understanding. What all the documents was, it was listed in as a private first class.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for the panel?
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, I would hope that in the future you might work with me on some bill that seems as straightforward as this one is and get that kind of fiscal, because normally mine don't receive that kind of fiscal, but you've done good work, obviously.
Be happy to do that, Representative.
Thank you.
Any questions on this side? All right. Well, thank you both. If you want to stay there for just a minute, we're going to call your father-in-law.
Sure.
And see if we can master the technology here. 9 7 9 7 1 6 4 5 Hopefully it's the right number.
Mine ringing.
Otherwise, we're ordering a pizza.
Hello?
Mr. Gilbert, sir.
Yes, thank you.
Hi, this is Paul Evans. I'm chair of the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness, and Representative Johnson and your son-in-law just gave great testimony about your bill. We wanted to invite you to talk to the committee and say what you'd like to say, sir.
Well, I don't have much, but he's covered everything pretty much, I think. But I will say hello and thank him. So, okay.
Yes, sir. Any questions for Mr. Gilbert from the committee? Well, sir?
Well, my name is Alfred H. Gilbert, Sr.
Yes, sir.
And Chair Evans and members of the committee, they already know this, but I was a PW in Germany and during World War II. And I moved in with my daughter and son-in-law just a couple years ago. And he knew a little bit about the Veterans Association. I never knew there were so many things I could have gotten through the years. Anyhow, he set it up for me, and I did get new hearing aids. And then he mentioned the license, and we were both under the impression that I could get a POW license one-time payment. And so we went up there, and that was not the case. The payment was $153, and it was every time the license ran out, I had to redo that. So he wanted to come back and get, I have 100% through the VA. He wanted to get some papers, and I did not want to wait up there another hour or two, so I paid for it and said, we'll worry about this when that comes up the next time. But he got a hold of Russ Johnson, and he carried it through to this meeting, and done quite a job, I understand. So that's about all I have on it. I just want to thank everybody that has had to work on it. And if there's any questions, can answer, I'd be glad to do that.
Well, sir, I don't see anybody asking questions, but I'll take the liberty to say thank you very much for all that you did. We wouldn't really be here without you. So thank you very much, sir.
Okay, that's fine. I want to thank all the representatives and Chairman Evans, and we'll see what happens now, okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
You have a wonderful day, sir. Thank you. Okay. Would you like to close?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate your time and all the committee members. As I said, you know, in the fog of session, you know, we get bills that you know are just give you a good feeling to be a part of. And I think I would put this in one of those categories. And I hope you had the information that we were able to provide, even the military's notification to the family about, first of all, that he had been captured, which his mother didn't get until after a month after he'd been, you know, just how things have changed so much. But we forget about what it used to be like to, you know, to go serve. And then just being able to say, well, we know he's captured and somehow he's in a concentration camp somewhere, but we can't tell you really what's going on and so forth. So not just the soldiers that obviously serve, but the families that, you know, yes, here on the home front who are, you know, living faithfully, that they assume that their loved ones would make it home. And fortunately, Albert did. And I think it's just a great honor to be able to honor him and any other POWs out there that have gone through this and their families. So I thank you very much for your time.
Go ahead.
I want to say that It's not the fault of anyone that these happened, because, you know, we've done something here and you brought it forward. It's been a problem that came to the surface and we'll correct it. I also had Bob Maxwell. I don't know if you know who Bob Maxwell is, but he's the only Congressional Medal of Honor recipient in the state of Oregon.
Right.
He tried for 50 years to get a license plate. And finally, he went into the DMV, and they said they had to get $16,000 up front, and he had to agree to purchase 500 sets a year. Well, we have 70-some Medal of Honor recipients in the United States. We have one in Oregon. So he came to us, and thank God we had Governor Kulongowski and the President of the Senate, Speaker of the House, and I, we ran a bill through within 2 weeks and got Bob his Congressional Medal of Honor plates. So it's just a matter of coming to our attention and letting us move forward, because we'll definitely make the correction.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, sir, thank you for your service in Vietnam, and also Representative Johnson, thanks for being a Blue Star Dad. And the home front is always as involved in the fight as everybody else. We'll excuse this panel and see who else would like to come forward. Is that the list? For Amy Joyce? Is this for this bill? Okay. And I'm going to assume that Eric is for the other, for the information hearing. Is that correct? Okay, so we're going to hold you until we do that. Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Evans and members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation here today representing the DMV. The prior panel did a nice job summarizing what the bill does in the current state of the POW, ex-POW plate. Correct that there have been 127 Oregonians who have selected this plate, and currently there are 33 with active registration. Of note is that a surviving spouse of a person who has this plate may maintain that plate after that individual has passed and may keep it either on the vehicle or as a memento. DMV is committed to finding a way to to provide and assist in providing this small benefit to these great Oregonians. Representative Lively is quite correct that often fiscals from DMV are painful, shall we say. We're committed to doing things differently in this situation. Again, 33 individuals today, maybe some more in the future. Typically, when we do a registration change, a fee change, permanent registration, that kind of thing, we automate the system, and that's what ends up having a large price tag. We're going to figure out a way to do this manually. We're not going to print new plates. It won't be quite as seamless as it would be if we automated a system, but it's a way that we can do this at very low expense and assist this body in helping to make this bill come to fruition.
So I'm going to take the first shot. So just so I understand clearly, we're going to make this work without a big fiscal.
Chair Evans, that's correct. The analyst indicated that LFO indicates it's a minimal fiscal. And again, the way that we will be able to do that is making it a manual process. So again, it's going to be a little less seamless than normal. So an individual, for instance, might receive a renewal notice, have to check a box and send it back, and then we would send them tags without a charge, for example. Rather than printing new plates that say permanent, making the system not kick out a registration renewal.
Right.
But that's how we can do that with a very low cost.
I like it when government works together. Okay. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much both for your testimony and for the agency willing to make this a priority to work around some of the more mechanical aspects. Thank you. All right. Seeing no other names that are for this bill, I'm going to close the public hearing, and we're not able to work the bill yet because we're still waiting on some paperwork. So just, I know the engines were running to move the bill, but we don't quite have the revenue. But once we do, of course, we'll be moving this down track. What I'd like to do next is open up an information hearing. I'd like to invite the Veteran Service Officer from Multnomah County, invited testimony today, Eric Inslee?
Yes, sir.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Please come forward and tell us about your program.
Thank you.
Because of time, we'd like to share maybe 20 minutes about your program, if possible.
I can do that.
20 minutes, there we go.
Time, but
or less. But given the fact that so many people live in Multnomah County, sometimes people are confused, really, about the fact that there's the VA hospital and VA regional and ODVA has a presence, plus the county presence, so we're looking forward to clarity and hear about the good work you're doing.
Okay.
Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Good afternoon. Chair Evans, Co-Vice Chair Boone and Escadal, and members of the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. Thank you for allowing me to provide information on behalf of Oregon veterans. My name is Eric Inslee. I am president of the Oregon County Veterans Service Officers Association, and today I'm providing information today as president of that association and not as a supervisor for Multnomah County, but I will be talking about how broadly the counties interact with local resources as well as the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs as well as FedVA.
Great.
As many of you are already aware, the issues surrounding veterans and their families are as extensive as they are broad. Most of the concerns veterans have are based not only on the scarcity of resources, but also the lack of adequate access to information that provide a gateway to federal VA benefits, as well as state and local resources. They think that's a vital aspect of how the VSOs are playing a role to try and add leveraging and as well as a bridge to those state and local resources. County Veteran Service Offices have been poised to expand our services and create awareness of county programs to include veterans. And with the partnership and support through the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, we are strengthened as county and state, unified in filing claims and providing advocacy for our veterans within our state. Although each of our county, Oregon County's approach to community engagement are varied, we all speak with veterans who face very similar barriers accessing federal, state, and local benefits. From housing to health care and disability claims to transportation, the issues abroad, so it's equally challenging to narrow the gaps between services without collaboration between state and local partnerships. And I think for what we've done in our counties, respective counties, that link and being able to collaborate with our community partners really allows us to broaden our reach geographically so that we can get to those veterans who also are less aware about what their entitlements are. And I think we heard from a gentleman today who shared very similar stories. And, you know, this is a consistent theme across several periods of conflicts, including the guards over our peace. As I said, for rural counties to metro, county veteran service officers provide leveraging opportunities to enhance other local and state services. We are a vital link to veterans by bridging that community partnership, and the greatest strength of all is the partnership between county and state. For example, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is the appointed service organization that county veteran service officers operate under. That relationship allows us to be representative agents for respective veterans in our counties, to be their advocate before the federal VA for whatever particular claim they may be. But even broader than that, at the local and state level, we're also the advocates for access to those resources, whether it be through city services, nonprofit services, as well as county services, as particularly county services, because many of our aging veterans are looking to county to either leverage or support some of the shortfalls they may encounter. With ODVA's, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs oversight, we're able to be representative agents before the federal VA for our veterans. With ODVA state pass-through to county veteran service offices, we are capable of expanding our reach to serve more veterans and their families that provide an incredible return on investment with drawdown from federal benefits. I do like to highlight one other aspect that we don't hear a whole lot about through our counties and the relationship through the Association of Oregon Counties. We have advocacy. We have a representative here today. That relationship is it allows the CVSOs to inform the Association of Oregon Counties and those county commissioners of the overwhelming need veterans and their families face. I think a lot of that advocacy happens here at the state level, but it also broadens that at the national level also to inform our electeds and other counties. It's a collaboration as well. Speaking from what has happened in Multnomah County, the best thing that's been a benefit to us is that ability for us to do capacity building between our county resources, the county VSOs, as well as our community partners who are also seeing veterans and their families for other service needs shortfalls that's happening. There's a scarcity of resources, we know that. But with that drawdown from federal benefits, we get to provide that leveraging to that shortfall so that veterans and their families can meet their needs. Who we are, the goal of the Veterans Service Office is to provide benefits information, assistance, and advocacy to all who have served and their families. Many veterans are unsure of their entitlements. Again, that is broad. That's a consistent theme across our veterans seeking services, is that we don't know what's out there for us, and we know less about how to access those services. But as they're going to, say, for instance, nonprofit organizations to seek housing assistance, they may get those housing assistance needs met at the nonprofit level, which is not directly something that the county VSOs deal with directly. But we are a resource to get some of those additional benefits or if they're entitled to it, such as HUD-VASH and several of the other local benefits for housing that's taking place. You know, in Multnomah County, we have some housing dollars that we are able to supplement to prevent eviction prevention for the most part. It's recurring. Those are county general funds that are allowed to make sure that veterans stay housed if they run into any risk of losing their housing, whatever it might be, or even paying utilities. Services officer through the County Veterans Service Office, comprehensive VA counseling, assistance with VA healthcare enrollment, claims preparation and submission, claims follow-up to ensure final decisions from the federal VA, which I feel like that's most of our repeat business because it's not over until it's over, until the veteran's totally satisfied with whatever they've sought to seek as a benefit or entitlement. We initiate and develop appeals when appropriate. If VA hasn't given a full grant of a certain type of benefit that the veteran disagrees with, we are those folks who will submit those disagreements, mostly in legal jargon according to the Code of Federal Regulations, to make sure that the VA is staying consistent with what the veteran is entitled to. But we're also explaining to the veteran as well as to our community partners how this process really works. It is a very complicated process. I have a PowerPoint presentation today. It's mostly meant for illustration purposes only to sort of show you how complicated that process really is, but also show that vital link to the CVSOs to so that we can solidify that system of care. Networking and advocacy with federal, state, and local agencies and groups. So I feel like that's the connectivity to our partners once again, and building on that collaboration so that we're all sending the same consistent message. So rather than saying veteran, we say have you served, to make sure that whatever it might be, that someone doesn't feel disenfranchised or underserved because they don't see themselves as a veteran or a family member of someone who may have served during a combat theater, which is not necessarily the case. There are all sorts of other entitlements that a veteran or a claimant, as we call them, would have access to. One thing that definitely underserved populations and communities of veterans, LGBTQ, women veterans, veterans within communities of color, justice-involved veterans, veterans who are at risk of homelessness, who are homeless currently. Those population of veterans typically are trying to get to that immediate need, whatever that shortfall may be. So what we're seeing is that a lot of these veterans aren't talking about the aspect of claims. If it's a housing issue, they want to be housed. So, you know, in our office, we see a lot of veterans who are either literally on the street who talk about getting into housing, and we get to help them navigate through that housing process so that they can actually stay housed. If it's an affordability issue, then we are talking about other types of benefits, whether it be through FedVA, through federal benefits, or even through Social Security Disability or SSI if they're eligible. Our justice-involved veterans, particularly, the recidivism rate is still climbing for all sorts of reasons. Those veterans oftentimes are really less aware or less informed about what their entitlements may be. So having a justice-involved CVSO in our office, being able to provide that information to the incarcerated veteran as well as to jail staff is an important role. So we're leveraging a lot through capacity building with partners who are doing direct service delivery to clients wherever they may be so that they can say, you need to have a conversation with the County Veteran Service Office. So the PowerPoint presentation, I'll get to that. Hopefully it'll raise some questions. So I have demystifying veteran services and the veteran service system simply because I don't think really that there is a way to demystify it other than, you know, the collaboration that takes place between state, local, and federal agencies. And again, FedVA is equally as much of a partner, even, you know, whether it's the benefits side or the healthcare side. It can be complicated. People have some misinformation about how that system works. I think the CVSO plays a vital role in that interpretation to make sure that everybody has equitable access. Understanding state and local partnerships. Again, capacity building, one of the things that we've developed in Multnomah County is through our AmeriCorps Vista project, which has a focus on anti-poverty, so that veterans who are experiencing poverty of some type are getting the proper information and that access. But again, people are looking at direct service delivery agencies who are doing that work. So as we're informing that local agency or local government who's doing the work, they are also being educated about the role of CVSO and also what our limitations may be. Again, the housing aspect being the very key piece. We don't do direct housing services, but we know whether housing agencies, whether it be through nonprofit or through the local housing authority, we know how to get them access. We know that VA also has HUD vouchers that someone may be eligible for.
Three,
Yes, we are not federal, state, or state employees. We work for our local counties. I think that's where a lot of the confusion comes into play for us, because I still have veterans who call and say, well, you're the VA. No, we're not the VA. If anything, we more closely resemble with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, because we operate under their power of attorney as an organization, which is equally confusing for our county staff, because they're like, well, you work for the county, but you're operating on the ODVA. Well, it's representation to be that advocate under that power of attorney. So a strengthening of that bond is, I can't begin to talk about how that is the best fortification we can have to get access, because no matter where a veteran may land, whichever county, that link to ODVA is constantly there. They get to transfer from county to county whatever data and information a veteran may have wherever they may seek services. So this is the tricky part. County veteran service officers are responsible for understanding laws and regulations pertaining to veterans' benefits. As their accredited representatives under federal for federal VA, the power of attorney is not traditionally what you would consider a power of attorney, but that's what we call it. It's the appointment of service organization, which allows us to represent and have discussions about what the entitlements may be, but also be that representative face before the federal VA. It does make it very seamless in a lot of ways, as long as our claimants are having conversations with us and we are actually staying on top of that follow-up and making sure that, again, the entitlements are granted that they're so obligated to receive. I always liked this picture, so I just threw that for aesthetic purposes.
It's a great picture.
It really does demonstrate the diversity of the veterans that we serve. That's really why I like the picture. It really talks to women, veterans within communities of color, our aging veterans, veterans who are disabled. And these are just basic statistics. I think they've been shared mostly with by ODVA and so on. So our Veterans Service System of Care, it is blurry, which also talks to the complications. We tried to squeeze every possible entity in there, and why the Veterans Service Office is that vital link. To navigate that process and talk to who's, where am I supposed to go to get these services, is pretty tricky. And I have to say this because I recently received this phone call from the Fed VA about how do we do such and such. Well, you're the federal VA. You don't know that? Well, it's like anything else. You're not going to be the lay expert in an area that you don't traditionally work in. The CVSOs are the lay experts in veterans law. In collaboration and training with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, we're able to really talk to what the regulations say a veteran or claimant may be entitled to and make sure that they're receiving those entitlements across the board. Local, state, and local benefits, it does become a collaborative conversation between those agencies, and the system of care talks through everything from the VA, overarchingly, one VA, but there are three components to the VA. The easiest to navigate is the National Cemeteries, because there's one-stop shopping there. Other than that, the VBA and the VA healthcare system, you know, it can change depending on what the person is seeking and whether or not there's a service-connected disability and so on. They put the community resources in there and our VA supportive housing, because that's a huge connectivity in Multnomah County. To make sure veterans who are homeless or on the street have access. We've provided, and I want to get this right, we want to go to where the veterans are in Multnomah County, and I think it's very similar in many of our counties throughout the state. We've set up at least 7 or 8 different co-located sites to try and meet the needs of veterans wherever they may land. The CRSC is one of them, the Community Resource and Referral Center with the Fed VA. And the other is now we have Transition Projects that is on site at one of our county buildings to screen veterans as they're coming into our county offices seeking VA benefits, who also are homeless. We can also make that warm transfer right across the hall to make sure that they are getting captured as part of the testament to our veterans home for every veteran. More complication to the greater mess of how the drawdown from federal benefits with from Congress down to state service organizations such as Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, as well as national service organizations. And they are an illustration of several. And as you keep going through, you see the pass-through to county veteran service offices. I know in Multnomah County, we're Aging, Disability, and Veterans Services Division, part of the Department of County Human Services. I believe it's very similar to that in most of our counties as well. So again, it makes sense for our aging and people who have disabilities to get to local resources, but it makes even greater sense that that connectivity to a VSO, as they have identified as a veteran or someone who served, sort of broadens that net so we can provide that leveraging to those resources as well. Again, when you start looking at state and local benefits that someone may be getting, the drawdown from federal benefits obviously provides a nice leverage. I think one of the questions came up about employment. Again, this is one of those areas where we're not the lay professionals in employment resources, but as we're screening and counseling veterans about entitlements, we're also digging a little bit deeper into what their situation may be. And again, it's that opportunity to be able to make sure that there is equitable access to the proper resources so that they can get whatever benefit. If it's employment, then we have the connectivity with our folks at the Oregon Employment Division so that they can actually get access to employment or training. So again, we're on college campuses to be able to deliver that message to our younger veterans who are less likely to come to our county buildings to seek services. They're actually going to finish their education. So it made sense for us to land at those college campuses to make sure that we're providing information. So whether or not they actually sign a power of attorney for us to represent them doesn't really matter. It's just to make sure that they have access to information so that they know, 10 years down the line, if something develops, they know where to go rather than relying on misinformation that can misguide. Those are some of our community partners. There's not enough room to list who they are. Our AmeriCorps Vista project, the capacity building component, is to try and bring a lot of our partners together to get information and also to provide some training to them as to the work of the CVSO. So as we're broadening that net, the law of numbers is what I operate from. The more people you're talking to, that expansion is just going to continue, and the conversation is there. The right types of conversation, because again, interpretation of the information that a CVSO may put out may be taken in two extremes, but at least as long as there's access, folks can call up their local CVSO and talk to what the reality is and how things work as it pertains to their respective claim. And the rest of that is just VA's claims triage process. I don't want to really get into the nuances of that. That's just a complicated mess in so many different ways. Just like to always point out the fact that as claimants, community partners are having conversations with the VSO, we're going to talk very broadly about how to gain that access. But overwhelmingly, we talk about make that referral to us so that we can provide you the information and or training. One of the things that I feel like is a highlight for our county is our secure, informal online referral process, where a partner or a claimant or a family member can make a referral to a veteran, and it automatically goes into a call log for us so that we can actually call that veteran up wherever that claim may be or wherever that referral may be, so that we can get to and be more responsive to a person's question. And overwhelmingly, For example, we receive about 1,300 calls a month. There's one person taking in those calls. Our turnaround time to those calls is about less than 8 hours. Our turnaround time used to be weeks, 6 weeks. So now that's been an extra added feature. And having a dedicated person to sit there and really talk to a person about whatever question may be as it pertains to their benefits. But because we're a county resource, we also get to broaden that conversation to our division partners as well as our statewide partners. I feel like that's all I can give you, unless there's questions for me.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Question, do you work with the veterans in filling out their HUD-BASH vouchers?
So I feel like that's one of our stronger partnerships, too. So in our office, I know a lot of the HUD-BASH social workers accompany many of the veterans to a claims interview. We don't necessarily help them fill out the application for HUD-BASH, but we do inform them about how that benefit entitlement may be. So the link is between us and that social worker to make sure that that veteran is connected. And the same thing for the VA supportive housing, supportive services funds that are out there. That's the same process for those organizations that have SSVF funds to try and get people into housing who are at imminent risk of homelessness.
Follow up.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Well, the reason I was asking is because I was at a committee meeting earlier today that showed some statistics of the Section 8 and the federal housing HUD, programs, and that the HUD VASH was really underutilized and not as widely used as could potentially be helpful. And so I was just curious, maybe you may be a resource to. I'm just curious who to go to help make sure we can try to get those resources to the veterans, especially when we're trying to work with homeless veterans right now off the streets. So,
I want to say that the utilization of both SSVF as well as HUD-VASH, and I know that that's been taking place in Multnomah County to make sure if their vouchers for HUD-VASH aren't readily available, then there's a possibility for SSVF to step in and pay for about 10 months of housing so that the person has some stability until they are actually able to actualize a HUD-VASH voucher if they're eligible. I think the part of that, your question probably pertains to the fact that not everybody will be eligible for a HUD-VASH voucher. We do have, there's income restrictions in a lot of different ways with HUD-VASH, so someone who's 100% service-connected for a disability will be over income for HUD-VASH, even though they may be facing homelessness or housing. So SSVF doesn't have that restriction to help pay for some of that housing as possible leveraging, but it does provide an opportunity. I had a situation in Multnomah County that was actually referred from the governor's constituent's office for a veteran who had Section 42, where it's an IRS code for being eligible for subsidized housing, was housed in the housing authority in Portland, actually paid for some of his housing. The veteran also put in for an increase in his benefits. What it did was it made him ineligible for Section 42. So he had limited resources, and it was a temporary 100% increase that he got for convalescence, which veteran had never connected with our office, was never really referred to our office. He just knew that I was housed, I was waiting on a HUD-VASH voucher, Section 42 had covered some of that subsidy. What came about from that was by the time he got to our office, they had already stopped his Section 42. VA had already made a decision to reduce him back down to his 50%. But he was responsible for paying $975 in rent that he did not have. And his statement to me was, wasn't I referred to you first? I said, I don't know. But we can capture you now, and we can take care of you. Got an increase in his benefits to 70%, got him into the county where he wanted to be. We continued to work with him Less than a year, he was 100% permanent and total based on his service-connected disabilities. So now he's gone from requiring local resources and to subsidize his housing to being able to take care of his own housing needs. And, you know, he's satisfied as well as his medical needs. His concern, yes, he was angry, and we understood that. We're okay with veterans coming into our office angry. We get to have that conversation. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Any other questions? Okay, well, first of all, thank you very much for what you do.
Thank you.
And second of all, thanks for coming down on a Thursday afternoon to share with us about what's going on. Really appreciate it. And
my pleasure.
From someone who remembers several years back when around the state, just because of resourcing, it was not uncommon for 6 weeks for notice. Just a kudos to get it up to the 8 hours, even 12 hours is good. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're going to close the informational hearing. Have a wonderful day.
Right. Thank you.
Hopefully your daughter can have a good rest of the afternoon.
She was looking forward to being here today.
Good. And we are going to now look at opening up a public hearing on three bills. Yep. Okay. We're opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2233, 2234, 2235. And just for those that are following at home, 2233 directs Department of Veterans Affairs and County Veteran Service Officers to provide aid and assistance to Korean Vietnam War veterans to obtain health coverage and services. And upon determination, what?
Deja vu.
Don't get me going.
On determination, the veteran is not eligible for health care coverage and services under federal and state laws to implement a program to provide such coverage and services. In a bit, we're going to go to 2234, which creates a subtraction from federal taxable income for benefits for surviving spouse or dependent child of service member. And then in the third spot, we're going to be talking about House Bill 2235, which authorizes county to grant exemption from ad valorem property tax for property of eligible veteran or surviving spouse remaining unremarried of eligible veteran in any amount of assessed value up to 100% or based on more generous eligibility standards. Take us away.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. House Bill 2233 requires the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and County Veteran Service Officers to assist Korean Vietnam War veterans and their spouses, dependents, or survivors in applying for any health care related benefits they may be entitled to. It directs the ODVA, VSOs, and the Oregon Health Authority to create health care coverage and services for Korean Vietnam War veterans determined to be ineligible for other state or federal programs. It declares an emergency effective on passage. The Republic of Korea contributed forces to fight along the United States in the Vietnam War. More than 300,000 South Koreans fought alongside America in the war in 1964 to 1973. Currently, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is authorized to provide medical services to beneficiaries of nations allied with the U.S. in World War I and II, except any nation which was an enemy of the U.S. during World War II. There are approximately 45 Korean Vietnam War veterans who are citizens of the United States now residing in Oregon. House Bill 2233 requires the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, County Veteran Service Officers to assist naturalized Korean Vietnam War veterans and their families residing in Oregon with applications for health benefits. This particular bill had not been referred to House Ways and Means. However, upon going to the Fiscal Revenue Office, it is a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means. Plain language for the fiscal impact, it is indeterminate, and for revenue, there is no impact issued.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you.
You have the floor.
Thanks, Chair Evans. Members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, representing Westland and Tualatin, bringing you our committee bill of House Bill 2233. First, I'd like to thank the committee for accepting the bills we're about to hear as committee bills. And so officially, for all those who were worried about whose name's on a committee bill, these came from my office. But I accept. I appreciate that we are making them committee bills.
Oh, sure. Claim the one people like.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
They do not have coffee taxes, cat food taxes, or anything else that I am bringing you today.
We're blaming you for those two, but yeah. Go ahead, Representative Parrish.
I get blamed for a lot around here. I am bringing once again, this is the third time, I am bringing this bill forward to us. And there is an emergency on this because these small handful of Oregon citizens are getting older by the day, and us not doing anything is not helping them. So you heard our committee administrator explain a little bit about the situation, but for those of you who are new to the committee and who have not heard this testimony before, the very quick background is that when the United States entered into the Vietnam conflict, war, whatever you want to call it, we also had partners in that, soldiers from the Republic of Korea came and served with our American soldiers in Vietnam. And we made a commitment as a country to those who were our allies that we would help them with the long-term costs of those wars. However, small little population, about 1,300 people in this country, are in a status of where they belong to nobody for benefits purposes. So these were folks who were Korean citizens at the time of the Vietnam War, and then later immigrated to this country, have become naturalized as citizens, and our United States Veterans Affairs does not recognize them. Mm-hmm. So we had in 2013, we had a group of these folks, and they came and testified in front of us. And we did one of those resolutions where we honor folks and urge Congress to do things. And of course, Congress doesn't listen to us. And so a group of us, including the former chair of this committee, Greg Matthews, and a whole handful of others, said, you know what, we want to take care of this. And as a committee, we passed that bill out of this committee, and it went down to Ways and Means and died. And then we brought it back again 2 years later, and it went down to Ways and Means and died. So here we are, and going into my third term of this, this is still a population that needs our help. They may or may not qualify for other types of health care benefits like Medicaid or Medicare, but the fact is that those programs might not also cover the types of long-term disease and illness that we know comes from experience of those who've served in Vietnam, including all of the associated healthcare issues around Agent Orange, people who have long-term disabilities that are physical ailments, injury ailments. And so it's a very small population. I have to say, and at some point, I guess we'll ask ODVA to come up, but when you look at the fiscal analysis, the notion that we would need $218,000 to staff an effort to find 45 people and properly give them benefits does not make any sense to me at all. The folks in the know for this group, I think they know where they are. I think we know how to find these individuals. Our own Korean War Veterans Association here in Oregon is connected to many of these individuals, and they're a pretty tight-knit group. So I don't think that we need to go out and do a ton of effort to find the individuals who could be qualified under this. So I sort of dispute the agency and the fiscal they put on this. I'm almost agnostic of how we help them get health care. They could be buying their own policies, and we help offset their premiums. We could slide and align them into our Oregon health plan. I'm emotionally disconnected from how we actually give them healthcare services. These are also folks who, if they were in our VA and they were disabled in our USVA, they would qualify for things like disability compensation. They would qualify for things like home loans and a whole bunch of other things. And if we can't figure out how to just take care of the basic need of their healthcare, it's sort of one of those shame on us moments. And the fact that I'm still here having this conversation 4 years later, almost to the day when we first had some of these folks come and testify in front of us is really sad. So I'm going to urge us to pass this down to Ways and Means. I would hope that the agency would get together, and I'm happy to do it with them, get together with OHA and figure out, or the health authority, figure out how to solve this issue so that we can address it with an amendment in the Ways and Means process that says, here's how we're going to do this and here's how much it costs. But from a policy perspective, this group of individuals has always supported the policy that we're going to find a way to take care of these folks. So I'm going to urge us to pass this. I'm going to urge us to all dispute the fiscal and find a way to connect to these 45 individuals, because I don't think it's that difficult. You know, the actual final outcome of the delivery of services, again, not wedded to how we do that. I just think we need to do it. And I think we're running out of time. I mean, if you look at the measure, we're talking about a group of people, you know, who served during the 1960s to 1973. I wasn't even born then. So we're talking about folks who are in their 70s, mid-70s, pushing almost 80 years old, who are still struggling. And we know we've got folks that we've served within this body who've experienced those health care problems that related to that war. It's just not fair to leave them out in the cold. And I think we need to do something about it. And I think we need to do something about it this biennium.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Representative Parrish on this particular bill? Go ahead.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So the maybe a little history. We don't know what they're attaching the fiscal to. In other words, so if I heard you right, to hunt them down, lack of better words, that's what the fiscal is?
That's how I read it in the fiscal statement, that it would be used to do the $218,000 to do the outreach to find these 45 people who I think we could probably do that for a lot cheaper. I'm happy to go help find them myself.
Not to jump on Representative Parrish's perspective on this, but we actually can
ask the director.
When she's done, we'll call the director up to make a response.
Right.
Okay. One at a time.
All right, good. I didn't know you had that scheduled, so okay, because I
yeah. Got you covered.
Me and $15 and we'll go find them. So.
Right.
And I'm not sure we want to use the term hunting them down.
That's right.
Maybe not.
Diligently but search, Representative Post. That's the word we're going to look for.
Certainly contact, I think, is we're with you. Any other questions, Representative Parrish, on this particular bill?
That takes
right.
care of all of them.
Director Smith, would you like to come forward, please? He doesn't have to sit right next to you.
I'm friendly.
God. Welcome, Director Smith.
Chair Evans, members of the committee, Representative Parrish. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I am the face of the faceless bureaucracy that's standing in the way of progress. And while we joke, I don't take lightly the issues that these citizens are having. They are allies of ours. I served with ROC Marines as a fellow Marine. Representative Esquivel knows, as a Vietnam War veteran, whether they were Australian allies, Korean allies, we could not do our fight overseas and on the battlefield without them. And they have gotten a raw deal, whether from their own country or simply not being added in, even to the federal VA that has historically often added in other allies from Filipinos to the volunteer Flying Tigers during World War II. And they've got the same challenges that our Vietnam veterans have long been overlooked and underserved. In terms of outreach, I mean, that is our bread and butter, and what you heard from Mr. Eric Ensley of the County VSO, we do outreach until the sun goes down, and that is absorbable completely. In terms of that core competency of our VSOs applying for federal VA benefits, whether they're health care or disability compensation, again, come one, come all, and we've driven down those wait times to get more folks and are continually augmenting more VSOs out there and even partnerships with the service orgs. When we read just the reading of this, though, it reads as if we are also applying, our core expertise is not on the Medicaid, Medicare, the Oregon Health Plan and the other, it would be kind of a county VSO referral to those caseworkers who apply for those benefits. No costs on term, you know, we are constantly referring both ways. When they get a veteran on their end that's better suited on a veteran benefit, we're trying to get those referrals over to us. We don't really have that expertise out of VSO land for some of these other healthcare benefits. And then they're often not going to be already signed up on a state something they are eligible for, often not for that federal VA. So it would be that default of standing up, you know, establish a program of health care coverage and provision of health care services to the veteran. We don't know quite how to read it. It doesn't feel like, and that we view it as on ODVA, not OHA in this bill. It's kind of in partnership with OHA. If it's a referral over to the Oregon Health Plan and adding them into the Oregon Health Plan, certainly a zero fiscal. But if it's us standing up a health care program, it would need to have some process. And I think if not on a staffing side, certainly on the fiscal side to actually pay for whatever that health care is.
Did your question? I'm going to try to channel Representative Post and ask the follow-up.
Yeah.
So what would you need for clarity? An amendment or a work group?
Chair Evans, members of the committee, certainly an amendment. But I would recommend that we amend it here before passing it down to Ways and Means. We do have an interest in better serving these citizens in a way that I don't know Ways and Means will have the focus and attention to figure it out.
So how about this?
And Chair Evans, sorry to interrupt. We need OHA is the expert on all things.
Right.
You do not want me running your health plan. We can get you access to federal VA health care and other benefits, but we don't have any expertise on health plans.
So let me ask this question of the committee. Would it be in the committee's, the committee perhaps benefit from having OHA, the director, and Representative Parrish come back to us in a week with what they think they can try to come up with?
Mm-hmm.
Is that
yeah,
to drive the fiscal down and to try to have a clear purpose of the service?
Sure. I do not want to be known as the committee that once again left Julie Parrish hanging.
Okay.
That's a good not. I like that.
Okay.
Good.
So
the buck stops here.
Sure, I can give you 45 reasons why we need to.
Okay. So
we will work on it.
What we're going to do is we're going to close this public hearing to move to the next one or next subject. But with a request, you round up OHA and the director and whoever else you think you need, and can you get that within the next 2 weeks?
Hunt them down. We can do that.
Okay.
We can do that.
Is that
absolutely
acceptable?
Happy to.
All right.
Is there anybody else who would like to make public testimony in this particular bill before we close this one out and move to the next one? Seeing none?
Okay.
House Bill 2233-4.
You had it.
House Bill 2234. We will be done by 4:30, and justice will be done.
Okay.
One way or another.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. House Bill 2234 permits surviving spouse or dependent child of service member to subtract qualifying military benefits from federal taxable income beginning on or after January 1st, 2017. Allows the total amount of qualifying benefits to be subtracted if the survivor is blind or disabled, and up to $30,000 plus 50% of amounts over $30,000 to be subtracted by other survivors. Requires rulemaking by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs in consultation with the Department of Revenue. Amends Oregon Revised Statute Chapter 316 by creating subtraction from federal taxable income used as the basis for Oregon taxable income for any qualifying benefits paid to the surviving spouse or dependent child of a service member. Generally, subtractions are items from the federal government taxes, but Oregon does not. Subtractions reduce the amount of income taxed by Oregon. The Oregon Revised Statute, Chapter 316, already permits several types of subtractions of income. House Bill 2234 would expand the list of legal subtractions of income when calculating Oregon income taxes.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Once again, for the record, Representative Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland and Tualatin.
Let's wind that back.
I should say that there, as far as a fiscal, it is stated that there is a minimal expenditure impact. However, for the revenue, they've got some sort of thing about impact in the millions. The measure has a subsequent referral to the House Revenue Committee analysis was developed. Further, it's actually referral to the House Ways.
Impact in, I'm sorry, they said impact in the what?
In the millions.
That's really interesting because there's only about 22,000 1099 Rs in the state, and they're usually very low income. So again, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, and I'm bringing you this bill because it actually is a very quirky piece of Oregon law. So years ago, there was a lawsuit around whether or not federal benefits like military benefits were going to be tax-free, and moving after October of 1991, retirement benefits or taxable benefits earned and accrued before October 91 are not taxable. So we're talking about your Vietnam era veterans. A few of your Gulf War veterans have a little bit of service time in there. World War II veterans, Korean veterans. So to walk you through a very complicated tax scenario, when you retire out and you've done your 20 years in the military, you are entitled to a retirement that is equal to 50% of your pay, and it's whatever formula. And so if you are somebody, and I'm just going to throw out some round numbers here. So let's say your final pay in the military was $4,000 and 50% of your pay is $2,000. You can elect to do one of two things as a retiree. You can elect to take that full $2,000, or if you have a spouse and you choose, you can elect to offset a piece of that income and say, I'm not going to take the full amount because I'm going to plan for my spouse in the future. And so maybe that's reduced by a few $100 a month and you are seeing less than 50% of your pay. Now, my spouse is elected to do that. And if I die before him, the federal government does not ratchet that back up. So it's a one-time election, and you're sort of rolling the dice that your spouse is going to still be here before you are, and that you're giving them this benefit. So if you are a military veteran and you're earning a tax-free benefit up until that October of 1991, it's tax-free if you are the veteran and the retiree. When you die and that goes to your spouse, then what happens is that 50% gets reduced again. So it's already been reduced once because you've wanted to give that money to your spouse. It now gets reduced a second time, and so the spouse even sees even less than they were when the veteran was still alive. However, what happens in Oregon is suddenly that becomes taxable income to the spouse, and it hadn't been all those years. So this bill is to address that little quirk in the law that says that up until that 1991 date, if your veteran was seeing that tax-free, when that income is reduced after you become a widow or a widower, that we're going to maintain the tax status of that. To the notion that it's millions of dollars, when again, right now, currently, there are only 22,000 or so 1099-Rs, military retirees, getting a pension in this state. I dispute that, but because I can tell you right now, our pension's not in those millions of dollars. So this needs to be fixed. It's a cleanup thing. And really, you're talking about low-income seniors. That's why there is sort of an income piece in here. We've capped that so that we aren't talking about, you know, generals' wives and, you know, colonels' wives. We're talking about people who are enlisted, people who have not a lot of retirement income coming in. And so we've capped those dollars in here. So I'd like to see us move this to the Revenue Committee, try to explain them to them in as plain of English as we possibly can so they understand it, because it is a complicated tax issue because it's tied up in lawsuits because of how we got to whether or not that cutoff date for retirement is tax-free or not tax-free. And then it's tied up in a very complicated military process for how we distribute retirement benefits once somebody's retired, and then to survivor benefits once that veteran's passed on.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Parrish before we open it up for other people to speak? I see no questions. There are none. No names. There's an absence of names on the piece of paper to testify. So we're going to close
that works.
Public hearing on House Bill 2234. And for the record, with a little bit of confusion in terms of how materials are presented, what staff wants to make sure is clear is that the revenue impact is indeterminate at this point.
Indeterminate. Okay.
Not in millions, but if it was provided, it would be provided in millions.
Okay, good. All right, make sure that's not the case. I'm sort of struggling with fiscal and revenue statements this week, so there we go.
We all are, but everybody's working hard. So we're going to open up, again, a public hearing on House Bill 2235. Mr. Folk.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. House Bill 2235 allows counties to exempt from taxation up to 100% of the assessed value of the home or personal property of veterans or their surviving spouses. It takes effect the 91st day after signed day. The background, Oregon currently provides a couple of property tax exemptions to qualifying disabled veterans and their unremarried surviving spouses. Based on an Oregon IRS site from 2017, the first exemption is up to $20,716 or the assessed value of the veteran's home or personal property. The exemption may be claimed by veterans with government-certified disabilities of at least 40%, by veterans with disabilities of at least 40%, as certified by any licensed physician, or also low income, and by the surviving spouse of any veteran. The second exemption based on this IRS site, is $24,917. This exemption may be claimed by veterans with government-certified service-connected disabilities of at least 40%. House Bill 2235 provides counties with broad discretion to grant tax exemptions up to 100% of the assessed value of a veteran's or surviving spouse's home or personal property, and to alter or lift the disability and low-income requirements together. We do have fiscal and revenue statements. The revenue statement is, it does require further analysis in the House Revenue Committee. Fiscal analysis is a little bit unclear as to what they believe the total cost would be. I can read part of it. The counties that may opt to make the changes allowed in this bill will necessarily have reduced revenue from ad valorem property taxes. The reduced revenue may require a reduction in expenditures.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you once again, Representative Julie Parrish. Westland and Tualatin, House District 37 with House Bill 2235. This is not an foreign concept. We've looked at this concept before. Clackamas County, where I live, locally would like the ability to create their own tax schedule that is not less than the existing statute. They'd like to be able to kind of create a slide rule effect. They could, right now the statute says 40% disability services, service-connected or 40% disabled veteran gets the percent, the dollar signs that you just heard from our committee administrator. However, they would like the ability with a local vote of the county commissioners to say, well, maybe if you're 30% service connected, we'll give you some portion. And if you're 100% service connected, maybe it will be a different portion. But in any case, how they create that own, their own chart, it will not be less than the existing statute. It will benefit more, but again, with a local vote. Because this is set in statute, they need to, and they cannot do this without us changing the law to make this permissive for them. So when we get into how much does it cost at the local level and reducing their expenditures, that's a local control issue. That's for them to decide that if they want to make that adjustment and move the slide rule in either direction, can they afford to reduce their own expenditures or, you know, offset that somewhere else in their local budget? This bill is really just about giving them permission. I do not believe it should have any type of fiscal impact to the state. It's really on them to make that decision out of their own county budgets. And so this is a nice way for them to, or in other counties, it's a may not shall. So, you know, Marion County doesn't have to make that decision. So we want to just be able to leave it up to local counties. Clackamas County, I believe, did submit a letter today in support. So this is, to me, is a simple policy bill, but apparently it'll get a referral to somewhere else and we'll go explain it to them again.
Any questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Parrish, do you serve on revenue?
I don't. Oh. I'm just going to send them a whole bunch of stuff.
It seemed like since I've been here, a lot of your bills end up in revenue, and I have never quite understood that tract either, so I was just checking.
I don't know. Goodness.
She's an ex officio member, maybe.
Ex officio. I should just start attending, because I think it might not be it at the same time I have another. I think it's 1 o'clock, right? I have no committees at 1.
Well, there
I should
you
just
will.
Go sit there and show up every day.
That might actually help. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Parrish, quick question. You said something about 30%, but in here it did say, if I'm reading it right, with disabilities of 40% or more.
Well, so that's the existing statute, is disabilities of 40% or more. This bill is supposed to be able to let them, I just threw out 30% example, says that they could do, if you moved it to 30%, of disability rating, that's still greater than the existing statute, right? Because you're giving that as a benefit to somebody who doesn't currently meet the statute. So that's one way to slide the slide rule. You could go all the way up to 100% disabled and change the amount greater than what the current statute allows. You could say, if you're, you know, just a veteran, we want to be able to do that and maybe exclude the disability piece. But I believe, well, maybe not just exclude the disability, but maybe you're 10% disabled. That would be more than what the statute currently says in terms of a benefit to a disabled veteran.
So I just reading the bill then, so it'd be Section 2A, is that where that's?
Any greater amount of the assessed value of the homestead. up to 100%. Applies different disability standards or none. So if you go to the line B.
Yeah.
That gives them the, again, that's the slide.
That's what
the
opens
other
it up. That's okay. That's what I was trying. I'm trying to find out because the C says of with a income of a veteran with disabilities of 40% or more or no limit.
So that's to preserve the existing statute, right? So that says basically that you can't do
this. I got it. So this is given, yeah.
Can't suddenly say, I don't want to do the statute at all. So that's to preserve the existing statute, but then we want to let them slide down for maybe people who have lesser amount of disability rating, slide up for higher, okay, and change the amounts around.
Clear as mud?
Just don't want any confusion down at the county level.
Got it. Oh. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
So I'd like to make a serious comment. Sorry for that, Representative Perry. I'm on her side. Not in, these are county taxes, property taxes. Mm-hmm. They're not state taxes.
That's
so
right.
I'm on her side when it comes to not understanding why this goes to our revenue committee. But we've been there before. But I'm a big proponent of letting local counties, right, and cities make choices and with their taxes. Right. So that's, it does. It's a little concerning to me, too, that somehow our revenue, but it's what it is, I guess.
I find that veterans bills, Chair Evans, Representative Lively, veterans bills, for whatever reason, my entire time I've been here, go to some committee to die. It doesn't matter if they're mine or not. That just if there's, you know, some way to put tack a little money on it, we just don't pay for it, which is what Measure 96 was all about. So when I look at some of the bills in here that could have a fiscal impact, I expect that out of our Measure 96 budget, the Ways and Means Committee will look at that and say, well, we're going to pay for these things. If we send them policy things that have a little bit of a cost to them, we're telling them, use those dollars. In my mind, we're telling them, use those dollars and do this piece of the budget that you've ignored for years at this point.
So
thank you.
Good summation.
Yes, sir.
Anything else you want to add for this bill?
Nope. You can go back to the 2013 testimony and watch the tapes. You can go back to the 2015 testimony and watch the tapes.
Okay.
There's plenty of
same
testimony.
One. So same
side.
There's no, there is not a name on the sheet. Would anybody, seeing none? Public hearing is closed on House Bill 2235. What, a couple of pieces of information. What I'd like to do for today, just kind of as a direction, if we can. First, we have gotten word from the Speaker's office that bills that go to Ways and Means, we need to hold. Other committees are doing that. But the good news is we get to make a recommendation at the end as far as which ones are our priorities. And by focusing our efforts, we should have a pretty good chance of getting what we want, given the commentary that was just added about the money from 96. That said, for today's lineup of bills, the first bill, House Bill 2233, we're going to hold. We're going to see what can be done in 2 weeks. We're asking the Department of Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. We're volunteering the Oregon Health Authority because they're not in the room. And Representative Parrish is going to lead that work group to come back. The other bill that we talked about earlier, 2149, we're going to hold because we're waiting on paperwork. But we recognize that there is a minimal fiscal. I'm anticipating, we're going to clarify, but I'm anticipating with that gone, we can move it to the floor, which would be good. But I am going to open up a work session and entertain House Bill 2234. Is there a motion?
Now, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2234 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue.
Okay. Representative Esquivel has moved House Bill 2234 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And the bill be referred to the committee to on revenue by further reference, by prayer reference. Is there discussion on this bill? We're moving it to revenue with, of course, a due pass, a little sticky on it. Seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
She's excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. Motion passes. Moves to revenue. When we get an update on when the public hearing is going to be, we'll make sure all members know. All right. We also are going to open up a work session on House Bill 2235.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2235 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2235 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Revenue. Not Ways and Means, revenue, by prior reference. Is there discussion? Seeing no discussion, please call the roll.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. Motion passes. All right. Just to clear up, we move two bills to revenue. We've got two bills that are going to be ready to go in the next 2 weeks. Tuesday, we have some good things coming. Mr. Volk, why don't you tell us about Tuesday?
Yes. Tuesday will be a very interesting day. We have two speakers, Representative Goldfinger from OSU, a seismic expert, and we have a geologist coming. We also have an expert on Aries system, my assistant, Representative Post. And we have a speaker also, so it'll be and also Bill 2140.
Okay. So just a heads up for everybody. On the work groups, I know that there's some confusion, a little bit of anticipation about the work groups. One of the reasons we're bringing certain speakers in before us is to ignite those conversations to help with those work groups. Again, no pressure. We have 6 months to get some of the conversations going. It's all going to be okay. The second thing is, on Tuesday, if you weren't scared enough by Mr. Yeah. Ivy last week, buckle up.
That's right.
Because Dr. Goldfinger is very good at reminding us that we are both mortal and living in a period of geologic change. So it should be good for everybody. Please continue to do the good work that you're doing. And without anything else for the good of the order, we are going to call the Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness closed. Have a good day.
So after Ivy was done, I want to help our mom out.
Yeah, I know.
After Ivy was done, I want to help our mom out.